In the Ring with Eusebius Makaiser. Eusebius Makaiser.
Welcome to another edition of In the Ring with Eusebius Makaiser. Now, as you know, I have been focusing on bullying at Rodine. Rodine is a private school based here in Johannesburg, and in our arguably most influential weekly paper, the Sunday Times, a couple of weeks ago, there was a front page story about bullying at the school. Now, the story is complicated because it involves parents who are seemingly very wealthy and politically connected that may or may not have managed to get the provincial education department seconded to the school to make sure that the alleged bully or one of the alleged bullies are back at school, despite the school having decided after an internal process that they ought to be at home for a certain period of time. Equally, there are some really difficult questions that had been raised about whether the school, in terms of its policy and processes, had handled this as best as they possibly could. And the story was of interest to me because we see way too many South African schools that are in the media every other month. And then we talk about it, it dies out, the news cycle moves on. 6 months later, there's another flare-up that happens. If it's not racism, it is bullying of some other kind. And it raises a question beyond Rodine, beyond Pretoria Girls, beyond St. Anne's, beyond what happened at St. Andrew's College. Each of these individual schools might make for a school-specific story. But at the level of the overall system and educational sector, you've got to be asking questions about whether our schools are safe spaces. Are they conducive to excellence in education? And equally important, beyond education in a narrow academic sense, are they places of wellness so that our children can come out as well-adjusted young adults by the time they leave the school system? And we know that when they enter the world of work, university, wherever they might end up, domestic spaces, public spaces, they don't drag behind them all sorts of developmental and other kinds of trauma that they had experienced at school, never dealt with properly, and their entire bodies and beings are imbued with toxicity that has its genesis in the playground, in the classroom at the age 9 and 10. And so I want to reiterate something that I've said, and you will hear me say it again in an interview that I have recorded for this episode, that I really am motivated here by the question, what does it mean to take the interests of children to be paramount? Because if you look at the behavior of the board of this school, the parents, the school, the poor leadership on the part of the headmistress on the face of it, it does not seem to me as if even our so-called top elite schools, where parents can pay north of 100,000 rand a year for their children to attend, that they get the right kind of returns for that investment. And they're partly responsible for not getting the right returns on that educational investment. And these are the children who eventually, because of their class positionality, become your boss, my boss, and we then ourselves are subjected to the kinds of bosses they are that may also have its genesis in the kind of educational experiences they had, what they were role modeled by their entitled parents and by the ethos of the schools and the norms of the schools they had attended. So in my opinion, the story of Rodine could have been the story of another school, and the story of any of our schools is important from a national point of view, because what happens at school doesn't stay at school. It follows us beyond the gates of the school. If you want to catch up, I suggest you start with episode 137. Episode 137. That, or rather 138. That is when I framed the issues. I told you the basic facts of this story. And that's an episode that I dropped on the 28th of November. I also interviewed the education department to ask it, why did you go to Rodine so quickly after the alleged bully's parents apparently reached out to you? Do you do this normally? or is this a case of political interference? So that was the first puzzle. I framed the issues and also engaged the provincial education department. So that was episode 138, my apologies. So that's framing the issues. Then one of my favorites was probably the conversation I had with Luke Lamprecht, who is a very well-respected expert when it comes to child protection and understanding how to make sure that children who are at risk or already have been harmed are back on a developmental pathway towards some kind of healthy approximation of, I don't even know what normal is in our country and in our world, where we are all just subject to the various forms of structural and institutional violence that we experience on the daily. But he is someone who really, really is right up there in the country. If you follow him on Facebook, for example, every other day he's in court as an expert witness in horrific incidences involving the abuse of children, children who are murdered, and trying to help out the justice system to understand what might have happened in particular cases. But he also works with schools to understand bullying, what is bullying. And the question we tackled in episode 139 was the question of what is bullying. So you may want to pause right now and go catch up with episode 138 and 139 and come back to this one. Or you can listen to this one. It's not going to spoil your enjoyment of the other two. Enjoyment is the wrong word because these are heavy issues. You can listen to the rest of this episode and then come back, go back to episodes 138 and 139. Here in this episode, I suppose if we had to give it a title, because the first one was framing the issues, the second one was what is bullying, this one, I suppose a pithy indictment of the school from the educational psychologist is Rodine is not safe. It's not a safe space. And I interviewed Sabelo Skitty, who's one of the country's best journalists, works for the Sunday Times, because he is the one who wrote the story that landed on the front page of the Sunday Times. And there's a couple of things we do. We try and remind you of the key facts, because we all have short attention spans in an age where we've got so many different competing stories that bombard our eardrums and our eyes. And we then carved it into a couple of themes. We talked about corporate creep or corporatism when it comes to the role of the boards in private schools. We spoke about the way in which the educational psychologist had indicted the school. We speak about entitled parents behaving badly, which is really, really important. And throughout all of these themes, we reflect on the paramount interest of the children and whether or not the approach to this entire matter must be a zero-sum game, or whether the school could have done better by having alternative processes and an approach whereby all of these young girls may yet become well-adjusted teenagers, despite the aggressive, adversarial, legalistic approach to these issues on the part of both the school as well as the parents who are involved. So that's what you're in for in this episode of In the Ring. And I begin with a recording I had done of a conversation between myself and Sabelo Skitty, who is an investigative journalist at the Sunday Times. And a couple of weeks ago, you might have seen that on the front pages of the Sunday Times, the story about alleged bullying at Rodine Junior School in Johannesburg had been covered by the Sunday Times. And something on the front page in particular, that obviously means an editorial judgment had been made that it deserves that kind of prominence. Sabelo, thank you so much for agreeing to speak to me on In the Ring with Eusebius Makhaza.
Afternoon, Eusebius. Thanks for having me.
Now, when I think about your work over the years, I associated with massive companies in the private sector or in the state-owned entities like the South African Airways debacle and it being fleeced as part of state capture. And then I see your name on a byline about parents behaving badly at a school in Johannesburg. How did you come to know of this story, and why was it of interest to you from an investigative point of view?
Yeah, so I think, it was off the beaten track for me. You're quite right. it was fun. I remember one of the comments from one of the editors was like, write it like a movie, doll. And I mean, you never hear that being said about, document trolling and, stories that begin with the word the. This was quite interesting for me, right? How it came out, how I came across it rather, was that it was in the context actually of abuse of power, I heard about this meeting. This was now the day after the Department of Education had been to Rodin. And I mean, we'll go into the background of why they were there just now. And when they were there, they basically gave the headmistress an ultimatum. This certain learner who had been placed on suspension pending the finalization of a hearing against her must come back to school or the school will lose its license. That obviously, piqued my interest. I was like, this is quite a hectic sort of ask, from the department. I mean, what we heard was that the HOD himself was there. And so were very senior directors from the department in that meeting. So for me, it was an interest to find out exactly why. And then I think what then became of interest to me was when I sort of uncovered the allegations about bullying. And the extent to which the bullying had gone. And, these were kids, 10, 11-year-olds. But you were hearing words like, taking her life and suicide being bandied around. Then that sort of interested me in the sense that you've got such, I think, for lack of a better word right now, hectic allegations or, such a serious situation. But you've got parents who want, on the other hand, this thing to be swept under the carpet, pretend like it hasn't happened. But then, of course, when we went into it, we actually found out that the school was just as complicit as some of these parents who were trying to sort of play down the situation.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to talk about next before we get to puzzle together the facts and just remind people of where we are at. Because I've done a couple of episodes focusing on the story in the last 2 weeks or so on In the Ring. You have covered it in the Sunday Times. A couple of months ago, there was a story in the Mail and Guardian. And a few days ago in the City Press, there was another revisit of the exact same issue that you had covered in the City Press this past Sunday as well.
Yes.
But it seemed to be very difficult to get a handle on the facts. And I don't know what it is about the school. I mean, I've reached out to them in my covering of the issue. You and I haven't spoke a lot about it. We've really sort of handled it separately, even though we are colleagues, for the record, under the Arena Holdings stable. But I've done this work mostly on my podcast, In the Ring. You've done it for the Sunday Times. And it seems as if the school's attitude is, if we keep quiet, the story will go away, and let's do the private sector equivalent of what government does, the sub judice rule. The thing is being investigated. We'll speak to you once we are done with internal investigations. How difficult or not has it been for you to get the school to appreciate the importance of clarity and openness, which I don't think personally is incompatible with the duty to make sure that the names of children are not mentioned?
Yeah. Look, I must say, honestly, Eusebius, I think by the time we had approached the school, just when we were about to publish, we had the stuff pretty much pegged down, I don't think there was much that they could sort of deny, as well as, some of the stuff had happened rather publicly and, people knew about it. So from that perspective, they were, quite amenable to sort of talking to us about that stuff. But of course, I mean, past that, they've clammed up. And for me, when you were sort of introducing this question, it jumped out to me. You've got so many different stories around the same incident. Even the story that I wrote does not give you a complete picture. of what happened. You know, it sort of gives you what is there factually, and then it sort of gives you the one side from the one side of the parents. But what's not clear is what the school, number one, did, ought to have done, is doing about it now, and whether now the matter is finally, you know, being sorted out or not. We do know that some of the stakeholders in this particular incident are not happy, you know, and they are not happy with the school, and they are not happy with how the situation is being dealt with. And from our side as the press, we also aren't happy because we don't actually know what the school is doing about it. The school has been great, like you say, at, you know, sort of kicking the can down the road, hoping that we're going to get swallowed up by ANC politics in December, and then January 8th and January, and then we'll be looking forward to, you know, things like the budget speech and then the normal stuff of the year. You know, but
which is a technical mistake, because we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We've both been keeping an eye, you on your investigative journalism beat, me on the political reporting stuff that I do as an analyst. And here we are, and we're back with this story. So from a strategic and crisis communications point of view, I mean, they just got completely crazy. There are hundreds and thousands of parents around the country. You're a parent. Many journalists are parents. This story is deeply personal and one in which we have a stake. And the issues you could not cover because it was beyond scope for your first report are bigger questions around institutional safety in general. And so, although we are scribes, we also come to the story as citizens who have an active stake in what happens in our schools, because our schools have got to be contextualized within society at large. And in that sense, this story is both about the actors in your report, but in another sense, it's also bigger than that.
Yeah. No, precisely, Eusebius. And I mean, if you think about it, I was just looking at another version of, you know, South Africa's rich list. And this school is the third most expensive school in the country. You know, so you're talking about quite a lot of rand that, you know, parents are paying. And now the question to ask is whether they are getting, you know, bang for the buck, or are they putting their kids in an environment where some other kids might feel entitled to act any way they want because they know that, number one, the school is not going to do anything about it, or they do know that the teachers themselves are scared of, you know, the parents that brought them to the school, or that they're actually dealing with a board that behaves like it's a corporation instead of, you know, an amalgamation of adults who want to see the best for young people.
I wanted just to deconstruct each of those little bits. Before we continue, the immediate news hook for this to be escalated, I assume, I'm not part of the editorial team in the Sunday Times, was on the Friday, we suddenly kept all of us working on this story and other persons connected to the school, stakeholders and community, that there's a fight, physical fight on the school. Now, that alone makes it titillating and of interest. But of course, we are not a tabloid at the Sunday Times. But you have secretly been working on the background. So you, for you, it was another piece of the puzzle. So you try and understand what's going on. But the real main piece of the puzzle were the claims around bullying. What exactly are the bullying claims as you understood them with the journalism that you'd been doing leading up to the dramatic Friday afternoon incident?
Yeah. So I think, and this is for me where it becomes, you know, quite interesting, Eusebius. So I think, please pardon me, I'm going to be a bit long-winded as I sort of go through my thought process here. So, you know, the initial sort of information we find out is that there's a young learner there. She'd only been at the school for about 4 or 5 weeks. Seems to have started to make friends. And then in the middle of that, you know, sort of budding friendship with this group of girls, there's a massive fallout to a point where this one girl now becomes isolated. And maybe some of this isolation then moves to a realm where, you know, it becomes targeted at her. You know, she's standing in front of the tuck shop. People are pointing fingers. They're laughing at her. You know, she's playing Foursquare. Someone just comes and smacks her and then claims that it's a mistake. Of course, all the other friends are laughing. You know, but whatever all of these incidents are, they then lead to this girl, for whatever reason, you know, misconstruing them to be, you know, big and, you know, important to her, important enough so that she even starts talking about taking her own life, you know, when she's engaging with the school therapist, I believe. you know, so the charges that, you know, these three girls or the alleged bullies were facing were all related to incidents similar to that. And I think for me, you know, and again, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm going to seem like I'm harping on the school thing. It's only because the school hasn't come out and spoken to us on the record in detail about how it's handled this entire thing. But what you then get is that when the school intervenes, they then write a general letter to parents and say that there's a friendship dynamics thing, you know, which I think, you know, was probably the first time where they were mishandling the thing. Now, the question for us there is that why would the school, when they are aware of what is happening, because you've got one group of girls on the one side that had been, you know, together through different grades up until getting to this, you know, age where they are in the school now. They've been at the school for a number of years. And then you've got the one learner who's new, not only being isolated, but now also being targeted. Why you don't get all of those parents in the same room immediately and discuss this thing with the kids is beyond me. And why you sort of play it down to sort of saying it is a friendship dynamic thing, you know, is then another. And then we know, of course, that the only reason that the parents of the so-called bullied girl jump into action is when the school psychiatrist, you know.
Yeah, or psychologist.
Psychologist. Rather, sorry, and I always get the two confused. So the school psychologist then writes to the parents and says, look, I'm breaking all sort of rules here, all manner of rules around how I'm supposed to relate with your kid when she comes to me and we talk about how she's feeling and how, you know, and how she's faring in the school. But I'm doing that because I'm genuinely worried that something might happen here. You know, then she lays out this thing for the parents. Now, what I expected was, of course, that the parents, the, you know, the alleged victim, were going to be incensed about this. But what I found particularly interesting is that when I was engaging the parents of the alleged bullies, they were also incensed about the fact that, why is it that we were learning about this? Because now this thing leaks. You know, obviously the parents are distraught. They share it maybe with other parents. And then before you know it, it's being discussed in a way that is not controlled, you know, and it gets to them. So now they're saying, why is it that we hear about something so serious, even about the potential conduct of our kid, you know, not via the school?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The other part at that point, Savelo, and this is why I'm so grateful you came on, because I knew reading your report that there's a lot of analysis that is not appropriate for straight reporting that I wanted to tease out. I had Luke Lamprecht in episode 2 of this series as a child protection expert. And I never really thought about it deeply until he unpacked the school processes to deal with this. And he didn't use this language, but the way I've understood him very incisively is to say the alleged bully has got unmet needs developmentally and needs to be on a path towards development so that they can be a well-adjusted young lady who can slot into society in a healthy way by the time they matriculate from the school. Similarly, the victim or alleged victim has got an intrinsic right to a safe school environment, with their dignity not being trampled on, and certainly not their bodily integrity and psychological integrity. But the processes that the school set up, until he pointed it out to me, were not the right kind of processes. They were very adversarial. They were quasi-judicial even. You get other children to write statements like witness reports, and even the charges, the language of charges, is the kind of language we associate with the cops and with the criminal justice system. It is not a restorative justice approach. And that's not to say that you can't discipline, he says. Of course, you can discipline so that a child can internalize and distinguish between right and wrong. But the entire approach here, from a legalistic point of view, is that the mechanism and the processes set up by the school were completely the wrong ones to ensure, parents aside, that all the children involved come out better early teens. And I thought that was really, really interesting. But because the school's refusing to accept a right of reply, it's very difficult to understand why they chose the mechanisms that they did.
Yeah. Look, I mean, that for me cuts to, you know, almost the core of what we're dealing with here. You know, I remember one of the questions that I had in my head was whether does the school actually have a policy, you know, that will deal specifically with, you know, this sort of incident. And I mean, I would imagine that that policy, for instance, would be different for the junior school than it would be for, you know, the older kids in the high school.
Yeah.
Because again, here you're dealing with kids that might be aware of the power that they wield and, you know, the what they're doing to you, but they're not really aware of what the implications of that are.
That's right.
I remember I was making this point to someone that had the worst happened in this case, and that a young girl had taken a life. Even, you know, the ringleader of those three girls that are alleged to have been, you know, tormenting her would not have, you know, celebrated that. In fact, I think it probably would have broken her, because she then would have realized that, you know, the actions have, you know, real life consequences. But I don't think that they are aware of that. And I think that the way that the school, and I agree with them, by the way, and I even made that sort of analogy of saying, you know, in our time, if there was a fight on the playground or whatever with the boys, and we all go to the principal's office, the principal then calls in whoever was a witness, and then they ask them in front of us that what happened, and the guy will tell what happened, and then you'll be able to quickly determine. And I suppose one could say that sounds kangaroo-ish, but, you know, the other one, of course, for me also went completely, you know, over the edge, where you had, I mean, this young girl was on precautionary suspension, basically. It might not have been called that, but it was a precautionary suspension, you know. And I do understand when the school sort of says, but we needed to create an environment that the alleged victim can be comfortable in. But you also then need to do it in a way that the alleged perpetrator then doesn't become a victim herself.
Well, I didn't even know the rules until I interviewed in the first of this series the head of department for the Gauteng Department of Education, that whatever your judgment about how best to create that environment to make sure that the alleged victim can go to school safely without fear, the person that has been suspended effectively can't be at home for longer than a certain number of days. And I stand to be corrected, but at the point at which the department arrived at school, which we'll talk about in a second, already something like 20 days had lapsed. Now, one can debate whether that was really egregious or not, if you can be taught online in a hybrid way, whether you're really deprived of your right to education. But, you know, the HOD says, I get that, Eusebius, but, you know, without us settling the debate, there's no substitute for the full set of educational experiences physically being on site. And after 20 days, you've got to be honest. Are you trying to expel the kid? If so, then go ahead and do the full shebang. If not, then you have to comply with this, the policy that says that you can only be at home for a certain number of days, and it's something like 5 or 10, but it's certainly less than 20. Now, I get how the victims or the alleged victim's family must feel about this, including the way we discuss this. But what I'm not trying to do as a commentator and as a broadcaster is to imply that there's some sort of moral equivalence between the behavior of a bully and the victim of a bully. But what I find about this completely unacceptable, even though I'm not a parent, Sabelo, and you are, many journalists are, is the idea of writing off children. And Luke made the point that because of COVID and all our kids being at home for 18 months to 2 years, many of them, the vast majority in terms of emotional development and maturity, are about 18 months to 2 years behind their biological age. So if these kids are all 10, 11 years old, many of them are 9 years old effectively in terms of psychosocial development.
And so to treat them as you would a workplace colleague who's an adult is just absolute bonkers.
No. And I mean, he's absolutely right, by the way. And I think, beyond the sort of lost time due to COVID, you've also got dealing with young people that live on devices, the influences that have are completely different to us. You know, they watch YouTube, and sometimes you watch some of these things that 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 year olds are watching on YouTube, and you realize that, this is, edgy teenager content. The kids are sarcastic. It's and they already in those things in these shows that they watch are quite manipulative. So these are the things that these kids are basically taking in when they watch what they watch. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, speaking as a parent who's had a child in a school who's had issues, with fellow learners and sort of, that amounts to sort of an attempt to bully or the beginning of bullying. You can't help but also think about the kid, because at some point you ask yourself, but like, what kind of home does this kid come from? You know, is everything okay there? Do we know the dad? Have we seen him? Which one is he? The mom, are they people that, we can actually just talk to first and try and find out that, is your kid okay? What's going on? Because in the end, you're not looking for revenge here, and you're not looking for, the other kid to be completely, cast out of society.
That's right. Yeah. So there's a third last question, and these are all biggish questions, although they're three, so it'll take us a couple of minutes. The politics of this. One thing that doesn't seem to be completely nailed down, other than me reading between the lines in your article, but I haven't seen follow-ups on this, is despite what the HOD told me, and the only reason I couldn't ask him a sharp follow-up question is that I didn't have information on me, and so I would have had, I would have looked really terrible from an interviewer point of view. But he made it seem as if they habitually go to schools where there are problems quite quickly from being notified to being on site. Now, that surely is absolute nonsense, Sabelo. What did you discover from an investigative point of view? I mean, when you describe how influential the parents are, and we can't reveal the identities because then you may as well name the children in the process, but you have potentially politically connected parents, wealthy parents, middle class to wealthy people who hang out with each other. At some point, Joburg becomes small in your social circles. Yeah. It just seemed to be too good to be true that a family is unhappy with how their child is treated in terms of the school's disciplinary processes. You blink and suddenly there's a whole delegation at the school from the department. even though Paniasa is no longer there.
So I mean, this is, and I mean, look, without really going into the identity of the parents, the parents are quite interesting characters, and I think for a lot of people, when they sort of see it first glance, they would have thought that it's the senior government official who actually intervened here.
Yeah, that's the assumption.
Yes, but actually, it's not. It's the other couple, right? And I mean, I'm not one that follows that sort of thing, but I mean, these are high-flying, I think, Joburgers, people that own businesses and are connected, to certain people. And I think when I spoke to the department, one of the things that I was able to do was to get them to concede that, yes, they were approached by the parent. No, they did not go and seek the view of the other parents. They just immediately took the information that they had there and they went to the school. And another point that I wanted to make here, you see, because I think it's something that perhaps does need to be visited at a later stage. The behavior of the parents did not make the situation much better here. Mm. I'm even now thinking about the period to which this girl was made to sit at home was actually made longer because the parents then wanted to bring in lawyers. And then once the process had started, then, of course, thwarted the process and said, no, they are not available during these dates and, you know, all of those sort of things. So you sort of saw the, same sort of dilly-dallying that you would see from, you know, a government official who's been charged and knows that they're on the way out type of thing. You know, so try and take the can down the road.
So let me just get that right. Is the point there, is the point in part that a proper investigation, if one had to do it nerdishly, of how the child came to be at home so long, is that it might end up being a combination of the school's decision plus the lawyering and legalese that ended up leading to prolonged stay in addition?
Yeah, I think it was. I think it definitely was. You know, because if you look at this, there were three of them, right? You see this? So there's the one girl who basically, I think on advice of the parents or whatever, they just didn't fight anything. They said, yeah, no, look, we appreciate what you're trying to do here, and she's pleading guilty, and we'll then, you know, do whatever steps that need to be taken to rehabilitate. And I hate to use that word with a 10-year-old.
This is the point, yeah, but we've commented on the inappropriateness of that model, yeah, but okay, yeah.
And then that was quickly done, you know. Okay. The girl was back in school by the time that that fracas took place on Friday. She had been back in school. You know, and then of course the other girl had been back in school because her processes had also run fairly quickly, you know, although there were lawyers involved and stuff. And then it was this particular individual. And I suppose the school had taken that decision because they were seeing that despite the fact that there was already this process, there were still sort of, you know, allegations of further you know, bullying and whatever that was taking place.
I want to pause over that now, not on another occasion. There will be space for fuller version on that. But I want to set that aside just for 30 seconds to complete my initial question. And let me put the question in a sort of juicy and blunt way. Was this inappropriate political interference at the school as a result of the connections? Or is the nominal answer the HOD gave me correct? I mean, it can be correct and also be motivated, of course, because the normal answer he gave me is we just making sure that the provincial policy is implemented correctly. If it says a child can't be at home for X number of days, we have a duty to go and ask the school, why is the child there after X plus 1 days?
No. I completely don't believe that. And I'll give you one or two reasons why. The first one, obviously, is because they didn't go there to ask the school. They went and they gave the school an ultimatum.
Yes.
They basically told the school that this girl comes back now, or you guys will lose your registration. You might be a private school and you might be wealthy, but we are government and we still have a measure of control and influence over you. That for me is one of the reasons. The second reason is that there was no process that the parent of that girl, the alleged bully, followed. Everything that I'm getting from the people that I spoke to is that there was a direct call to someone influential in the department for this thing to happen. I'm not able to give you who exactly that person is. It was not a case of a parent going to a district office and finding out how do I resolve this situation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Yeah.
And I mean, of course, there were other things that took place here that, you know, we never really wrote about. One of them, for instance, and I think, I mean, it's worth putting out there because, again, it speaks to an abuse of power, is that there was an apparent call made to the parents of the alleged victim from a gentleman who then said he is a policeman at Sandton Police Station, proceeded to give a name and a number and a rank and all of that, basically saying that, please don't mess with this family. This is not the family that you want to mess with. We understand that you guys are new in South Africa. You might not know how things work here. You know, that was basically the tone of the conversation. And I mean, this is a face for me that I have seen around Sandton Police Station. So it was something that when I saw it, I definitely thought, like, this is possibly something that could have happened.
Absolutely. Second last issue I want us to ventilate. The board is a very important part of this conversation, and the board chair in particular, I want you to, so far as your investigations are going and ongoing, describe the board dynamics to the listeners. What I will say is the following. In my, and Sabelo and I have not, for the record, been working on this together, but it is interesting. After my first two episodes in the series focusing on Rodin, how many people have called me? I've got old girls from the school, stakeholders who've multi-generational connections to the school, teachers who are speaking to me, former teachers, current teachers, all off the record. And I'm absorbing all of this and trying to get a handle on it. I'm also holding back on what I've been told, both for ethical and confidentiality reasons, but also because in journalism, you have a duty, at least if you take your job seriously, to triangulate, corroborate, to test rigorously before you put stuff out there. And what I will share is the following, that my one hypothesis of where things are going wrong at the school, and if education was my beat, which it's not in journalism, I'd love to explore this with many other schools to see whether there's a pattern, assuming I'm right about Rodin, Sabelo, is that the board is enormously powerful, more than I realize in the 90s as a first generation coconut at Graham College, how much power the parent teacher association can have. In this case, it's a board. And it seems to me as if who is on the board, what they desire for the school and their friends whose children are at the school can play a major role in everything from who the headmaster, headmistress is, who comes and go amongst the teaching staff, who gets hired for DC processes. I've even had allegations here about interference in appointments of, for example, who becomes the head prefect of a school. And it made me realize, as I'm absorbing all of this, Sabelo, that your story, the news hook, is the new family that arrived in term 3. But Rodin has got an institutional problem of potential corporate creep on the part of the board that is a long and ongoing problem that teachers can't speak about because they're employed and they're scared, and that the members of the board wield massive amount of power, and that the Sunday Times story, important as it is actually one small part of a longer timeline.
Yeah. So, I mean, this for me is one of the most important ones. And I was actually even thinking about how do we actually be beyond Rodin, sort of go into that space and look at, how these schools are set up and the sort of influence that these folk have. Hmm. But for me, one can't help but draw parallels, right? With a typical school in the township where the PTA, for instance, will want to have a say on who gets the contract to cut grass, which teacher gets made a subject head and which teacher doesn't make a subject head. You remember that not too long ago, there was a school, I think somewhere in the West Rand of Joburg, where the parents were up in arms led by the PTA saying that they don't want a particular teacher to be made the principal there. Mm. And that one had sort of like racial connotations. But I mean, to me, it's sort of, we are quick to sort of, I think, notice it in public schools, and we write about the sort of influence that because often these PTAs are politically aligned, the SGBs, they are politically aligned. So you will find that the activist in the community is also maybe the chair of the SGB in the school. And so you'll see that they're trying to influence things in a certain manner. And it's no different here, by the way. And I think for me, the experience was that one of the things that made me worry in this particular case was the fact that you had this one parent. And as a result, the parents of the bullies are now worried because the parents of the victims are no longer talking to the headmistress, for instance. They're speaking directly with the board. Specifically the chair of the board, about what ought to happen. And My main sort of worry with that was because you're looking at the sort of process that had undergone here. At some point, this particular matter is going to end up with the board, maybe one of the parents are appealing, you know, a finding of this entire disciplinary process. But now the chairman of the board has already been inserted in this entire thing because they are already talking to the one party and the other party don't have access to the chairman of the board. And these are operational things. And then you also get the sense that there have been, you know, certain things that the headmistress has wanted to do or has done that have been overruled by the board again, you know.
In yeah, this I mean, that's exactly it, right? At the risk of sounding like Sandy Lengobo, on the face of it, it seems as if the board is getting involved in the minutiae of operational matters way beyond setting policy and only fighting fires and making high-level strategic decisions.
Yeah.
And when I am ready and have corroborated some of what I've heard, and that this is therefore the most I will say, a lot of what I've been approached with is in the direction of that kind of overreach on the part of the board.
Yeah. Look, I mean, for me, it was something that the parents of the alleged bullies, you know, pointed out very quickly to say, we don't have access to the board, but we do know that the board from time to time inserts itself in this thing, acting as agents for the parents of the alleged victim, right? And when I then spoke to people on the other side, they then confirmed that, no, they are talking to, you know, the chairman of the board. So it becomes a bit of an issue for me in the sense that the chairman of the board is not getting involved at a point where she's interacting first and foremost with the headmistress as yes. the custodian of whatever is happening there.
That's right, yeah.
You know, they're getting pulled in, you know, via people that are directly involved in what is an emotionally charged situation because no one is, and I mean, I don't want to belittle the behavior, but I mean, no one is thinking rationally.
No, I think that's absolutely spot on. I think it's really spot on.
Chair is being pulled into that,
yeah.
you know, from one angle. And then they are going to instruct the headmaster that certain actions must be taken.
Yeah.
I think it's part of the reason why you sort of see the tone which this situation took.
No, I think that's right. Yeah. Absolutely
to
right.
Exonerate
yeah.
the headmistress. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know enough to completely exonerate her. I think that at some point she mishandled it to a point where it blew up. But there is, for me, an element to sort of say, once the board stepped in, things moved in a very sort of like corporate adversarial sort of legal
Absolutely.
Way.
Yeah.
You know, Absolutely. Where perhaps yeah. that wasn't the route.
Okay. So to summarize, before we get to the last question, it seems, depending on whose perspective you take, I'm convinced until someone gives me overarching or overriding reason to the contrary, that Luke Lambrecht's critique of the DC processes are compelling. It was too legalistic. It was too adversarial, winner takes all. It mimics too much what goes on in the criminal justice system, wholly inappropriate for 10, 11-year-olds. That's the first big issue to continue fleshing out. Then there's the potential here for political capture of schools if you have connected folks managing to get the politicians or political principals to get high-ranking officials to very quickly go to the school. They might be able to do so on nominally correct reasons, but if they're motivated by friendships and by connections, you are setting a bad precedent. Then there's the question here of, in private schools, what you and I have referred to as corporatism, or corporate creep, where you have all these super brilliant CEOs, CFOs, people who come from the private sector. On the face of it, they might be useful for fundraising, helping to run the school, but they bring a certain kind of way of doing business to an educational space, and questions must be asked there whether that's optimal. Then there's a theme I haven't focused on. I might have to do so in the new year, where a couple of people read your piece, listened to my first two podcasts of Bello, and said, what you guys have missed, Eusebius, is an important angle, the impact on the teachers. Teachers feel completely disempowered. There's a high turnover of staff in these schools, including in the senior school at Rodin. The school will give you a PR answer and say that many of the staff are due for retirement, but it masks the fact that many of them are simply hurtful because they are politically fearful of the board and of powerful parents who complain about how they go about being teachers. And that's something that we can't discuss here for the sake of brevity. And then there's the last aspect, which did make me miss being on radio, because I would have loved to open the lines and say to people, call in, because it requires us as Black people in particular to have this conversation. And you and I can at least have it and hope that it's of some interest to our listeners. What is interesting about the story is that, with the exception of one parent, it all involves Black people. So there's no racialized element. And what's interesting about that is that you can focus on things that you can't focus on when race in South Africa gets in the way of talking about things that are also important besides race. And here I want us to talk about the entitlement of wealthy parents. So you've got parents who are connected, who are wealthy, you've got lots of money, and there they are demanding to be on a bus going to pantomime to chaperone the kids. Another parent hears about that, runs to go and grab her child off the bus. And it's the equivalent of what you and I would have stereotyped in the 2000s and 90s of all the white parents coming to the rugby festivals and fighting on the sidelines or with the ref. And this is a variation on that, but it happens to be middle-class and wealthy Black people. Many of the teachers who've spoken to me, some of them are teachers of color. Some of them are white folks who feel like, oh my God, we can't say that, Eusebius. But what they really want to also center amongst everything you and I have spoken is the question of the excessive role modeling of bad behavior on the part of wealthy and connected Black parents.
And it's something that I think is not even a function of the race, right? I think it's just people that
it's a class issue.
Probably have been seeing this sort of behavior, and are now in a position where they can actually also throw their weight around and assert the rights that are not written anywhere, but are expected by, you know, a certain class or caliber of individual. I think one only needs to hang out with, you know, guys who went to Vince, or guys who played rugby at Bishop's Weinberg, Gray or whatever. then you know, you see a bit of it. I've got a mate who teaches at one of, you know, the more prominent schools in Joburg. It's not this particular school. But I think we were discussing this story and we were saying, look, I mean, these are issues that we deal with on a daily basis. You know, the parents that feel entitled to send you an email at 9 p.m. How my kid is performing. And you must respond to that email before you go to bed. Otherwise, the first call in the morning is the call from the headmaster.
Absolutely. And that's my point about the pressure on teachers. That's not even in the conversation. Yeah. But that entitlement, you're right.
Yeah. And I think it sort of transposes onto the kids, because the kids then become aware that, you know, my dad is an important character here in the school, you know, or is an important character in society. And thus it buys me, whatever capital it buys me, and I'm allowed to do certain things that I wouldn't ordinarily be allowed to do. And I think it now, you know, manifests itself or seems as if it's, you know, it's a Black middle class or, you know, higher than middle class problem, because there's more Black people occupying the spaces and there's more Black people fighting.
And let me also just be clear before we deliberately get misunderstood. I think wealthy and white people in general have been behaving badly all along. But because we were the guinea pigs going to these schools, our generation, our parents didn't get involved in these structures. And so for all I know, white professors and white lawyers were secretly fighting anyway. We just didn't see because our parents weren't there.
I think that example you gave about the rugby field is the perfect one, because that's what it was, right? You would get picked for the 18 at the trial session this morning. And then the guy whose dad builds the fence or maintains the fence at the school, their kid will suddenly, you know, tomorrow when the coaches have time to think about it, he'll suddenly become a starting player and you starting off the bench, you know, type of thing. Or when, you know, the bags get made for tour, you're one of the starting players, but suddenly now you've got number 19 bag or whatever, you know. It's those things. And I mean, I get it. It's the privilege that's there. And I think what we maybe haven't done with the transformation is that we've not gotten rid of all of that elitism.
That's right. Yeah.
All of that.
We went into these systems and we didn't truly decolonize them. We've simply mimicked the institutional norms and values that so many of us otherwise could write lyrically about as undesirable. But then lo and behold, there you are on a Friday, and a video circulates of you fighting. I mean, that wasn't the point of taking over these institutions.
No, not at all. Not at all. And I mean, especially, you know, when you realize that the fight is created by, you know, one parent insisting that they are going to go and view this play. I doubt they even
a whole pantomime. I mean, if it wasn't for children being involved, which is the last thing I want us to want, I'm going to give you 1 minute to wrap here, then I would laugh at it more. For me, the reason for those parents who keep wondering, why am I in this story? I love the school. I've got friends who went there. Many of the people involved are people that are dear to me. And I love all South African schools that have such an incredible history of providing excellent education such that their matriculants could slot in overseas anywhere and travel socially and educationally because of the quality of the education they get. But there's something to come back to, a legal concept that is at the heart of family law when it comes to children. The interests of children are paramount. That phrase you will find after the constitutional dispensation all over our case law related to children. And when boards are overreaching, when a headmistress doesn't show effective leadership, when teachers are not allowed to be teachers, when an educational psychologist isn't listened to, and when influential, wealthy parents are behaving badly, it's the children, ultimately, Sabelo, that despite 155,000 rand a year, are getting a poor education.
Yeah, I think I couldn't have said it better, Eusebius. This, for me, is part of the reason why I ultimately wrote the story. You know, when it came, I could have passed it along to a colleague, but I did it because I really felt that everyone... the way that they were behaving, even with the little information I was getting, the way that they were behaving, all of them, what mattered more was their egos and, you know, them, as opposed to actually remembering that this is about young kids. You know, this is about 10, 11-year-olds. You know, one of the things that came out for me, for instance, in the story is that there's parents who actually took their kids out of Rodin.
Yeah. Before term three, which is why this story is the tip of the iceberg. Yes.
You know why? Which is, you know, precisely because of how they were being treated by these young girls, and these young girls also don't know any better. You know, what are we teaching them if we're teaching them that all mommy or daddy has to do is to make a call, and then tomorrow you'll be back at school? You know, for me, like when I found that aspect out, I was actually a bit sick. You know, it said that after the Department of Education had left, then the parents on the parents' WhatsApp groups were already talking, you know, that, hey, she's going back to school tomorrow morning. And, you know, the parents of the victims have been told by other parents that, you know, she's going back to school, apparently.
Sabelo, I love your work. We're going to keep at this story because we can work on many stories simultaneously. Our children spend a lot of time at school. And also, as I said to another mate of mine, the kind of adults we become, the bosses we become, the colleagues we become, the lovers we become, can be fundamentally shaped by what happens when we are in school. And it's not hard to draw the dots between schooling experiences and many other spaces in society, which is why this is a story that is not a parochial story about one school, but about an entire society. thanks for having put it on your radar, even though it's not a classic big corruption story. And I'm also glad that you committed to keep with the story, as I am. And I reiterate that the school has a right of reply. And even that's putting it badly, because we just want to understand your perspective and get you to be in conversation with me. And in Sabelo's case, answer questions, as you heard, from a journalistic reporting point of view. Thanks so much for coming on, Sabelo.
Thanks so much, sir. Go on.
In the ring with Eusebius Makhayza. Eusebius
Makhayza. Okay, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. It was far longer than him and I had intended, but I deliberately did not blunt the issues too much, although I think there are aspects of it we can return to. For example, I really want to make good on my promise to many of the teachers that have reached out to me, and if you want to do so, I give you my complete assurance that you can do so, secure in the knowledge that I will not betray your trust. We should focus an entire episode, really, on South African teachers, a couple of episodes. And that's a big theme that's been missing in the coverage of this story. I think that's important. And then on the themes that are familiar to you already, having read the Sunday Times story or having listened to the first two installments in this series, there are factual aspects to the thematic areas we have framed for you that are not yet in place. That I blame on the school, because the school, which I've criticized them for on this platform, and I do so again, thinks that the best way to deal with crisis is to shut up, hope it goes away, hope that Christmas will distract you, hope that the ANC elective conference will distract you. It won't. It's easy to return to a story, because those of us who have been journalists, broadcasters for a long time don't have short attention spans. And this is not an event. This is an institutional and sectoral issue. And for that reason, and precisely as I said towards the end of my conversation there with Sabelo, because ultimately this is not about Rodin, but about society at large. And ultimately, because the Rodin story is not about what happened in Term 3, but a very long timeline preceding it of letting down the girls, despite the amount of money that flows through that school. I'm going to stay with this story, and I know many of my colleagues will as well. But I wanted to just pick up lastly on one element of my conversation with Sabelo, where we skimmed over something. He referenced the educational psychologist that had engaged and interviewed the victim, or the alleged victim. Now, we've got an ethical duty to not disclose information to you that is inappropriate. The most obvious is that we can't put photos of the children in the newspaper, we can't mention them. And already, the way the story has been covered and grown legs, not just because of journalism, but because of the unnecessary bad blood that has developed between the various parents in the story, I think many of you, depending on the circles you travel in, probably had figured out, unfortunately, who some of these families are. But we're not going to contribute to that and make it easy for you to figure that out, because that's irrelevant. I want us to focus on the issues. And for me, the Rodin facts are simply a heuristic device through which to talk about the issues that are common across the sector. But I do want to say a little bit more about that reference that Sabelo had made. And I have seen it landed in my lap, some of that correspondence, so I've got a sense of what it is the educational psychologist did conclude. And I can't, for obvious ethical reasons, tell you about conclusions that are very peculiar to the child involved, but there are lots of sentences in this write-up that indict the school. And that's of importance to every single stakeholder of the school and to all parents and anyone who's thinking of sending their kid to the school. For me, the one sentence that is very plain and very short that Sabelo alluded to, and I can confirm with you, I'm looking at it right now as I am speaking, is this sentence. Quote, "I believe that as a school, the pupil's safety is paramount. Okay? So that's her preface before she tells us what she thinks about the school. The next sentence, unfortunately for your child, Rodin has not been a safe space. And maybe in a future episode, after getting appropriate advice, I might decide how much more to share with you. But I can tell you that that is, putting it mildly, this is not just an assessment of the difficulties that the victim has gone through, but also of institutional failure. And this is an educational psychologist that is a registered member of HBCSA and who is an employee. In other words, vetted by the school, not someone chosen from the outside to come and engage in an exercise of confirmation bias on behalf of the parents whose child displayed suicidality, as you have read in the newspapers. But those two sentences, I believe that as a school, the pupil's safety is paramount, which we all should agree is trite. Unfortunately, Rodin has not been a safe space. Now, maybe that's why the school is running away from engaging us in the media, because they'd have to explain to us what they make of an educational psychologist that they have faith in coming to these conclusions. If you rubbish the educational psychologist, the question is, why did you have them as an employee in the first place if they don't have any integrity? But if you do have them as someone that you agree is professionally sound in their judgments, then you've got to respect their judgment. But their judgment is that the school is no longer a safe place. And I want to leave it there. And again, I invite the school to engage us, because every single well-meaning, loving old girl, stakeholders, teachers who want to see the school thriving would like you to answer a bunch of questions. And those questions are not specific to what happened in term three. It's not about this girl. It is about story after story after story in a much longer timeline. You know it. I know it. You know that I know it, which is why you don't want to speak to me. And ultimately, as I said to Sabelo, as much as I love the Sunday Times story that he did, the Sunday Times story is just the tip of the iceberg.